In this Climate Gen episode, I speak to Silver Lining Institute Executive Director Kelly Vanter about the urgent need to invest billions of dollars into expanding our global coverage of climate modelling capacity. The worsening risks we face mean climate interventions to cool the planet are back in discussion in the corridors of power. We discuss the holdups and the necessity for research that could give all of us a clear idea as to whether such schemes should be deployed or not. We also discuss how engaging the talents of the Global South scientists beyond the current superficial level could be a game changer in advancing our ability to respond and to intervene in order to counter the catastrophic impacts of warming we are seeing accelerating all around us. In the next episode, I speak with Dr. Lev K. Caesar at Maynooth University in Ireland for an in-depth discussion about the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, known as the AMOC. The AMOC delivers warm weather to Northwest Europe and plays a critical role in the stability of the global climate system. But what happens if it drastically slows down, or even stops? Thanks for listening to Climate Gen. You can support my work by backing us on Patreon and get additional content early. You can also share episodes, send feedback, or subscribe for free on YouTube or any of the major podcast channels. Kelly, thank you very much for speaking to me today. There's been a combination of concurrent extreme heat waves, flooding events, and so on in recent weeks around the globe. And also scientists in Potsdam have just put out a paper that said we need to look more closely at things like cascade events or tipping points. How does the work you do at Silver Lining respond to these challenges that we're facing right now?
Thank you for having me, Nick, and thank you for the question. My organization, Silver Lining, our mission is specifically focused on near-term climate risk, which we define as the sort of 30 to 50-year time horizon. We started Silver Lining 4 or 5 years ago with the concern that, you know, in all of the projections for emissions and for the Earth's pathways coming from the scientific community, the Earth would continue to warm through the middle of the century, which is what we're seeing. And then as we dug into, you know, how big a problem is that, we sort of looked and saw that there's a lot of uncertainty in what we know. We don't have like super great coverage observationally of what's happening. And we have a lot of more weaknesses maybe than we appreciated or than people appreciate in our model predictions. So we have this uncertainty, and that uncertainty includes the kinds of things that we're seeing now, which are, you know, catastrophic events that happen as weather conditions get more extreme. And so the Earth warms, the extremes get bigger, and we have some uncertainty in terms of how often and how big those extremes get. So that's a problem in that we know we're going to continue to have more of these kinds of disasters associated with extreme weather, and we don't know enough about that. Then there's this wild card of, you know, the big natural system responses. So they're getting stressed and stressed and stressed by warming they're not used to, whether it's ice sheets, forests, or the ocean circulation. And at some point, they undergo a really big change. And often that really big change feeds back into the system more warming. And so that's kind of out there as a wild card. And the big problem that we saw is that our level of uncertainty is far too high and our level of insurance is far too low. And by insurance, we mean, you know, what are those things that we would do from a disaster risk management perspective to respond if we need to. And so that's how we ended up in Silver Lining, looking at some of these things that we and many people call climate interventions, which are, you know, what could act quickly on the system if the extremes are too big or if these natural systems are reaching a point we can't let them get to. So that's where we come into kind of this picture. And if we look at what's happening now, I would say the symptoms, if you like, the extremes that we're seeing, they're tracking at the far end of what climate scientists maybe 30, 40 years ago thought might happen. We're in the sort of far end of what looks like a really bad place for climate change, the kinds of things that we're seeing. And so now it's really important that we focus very hard on getting better information so that we can optimize for safety. Safety in these fluctuations and these disasters that we're seeing, and safety in the big picture, that we don't let things tip that shouldn't tip.
And you're talking about interventions, and this is obviously going beyond mitigation now, and it's somewhere sort of in between mitigation and adaptation in some ways, although, you know, it all has to happen at the same time. I know that you are involved with research into marine cloud brightening to increase Earth's reflectivity, amongst other things. Can you give us an overview of where you see the application of this technology being most effective in terms of, is it Arctic cooling, corals, glaciers, aerosols, or?
Thanks for the question. Yeah, so I mean, the first thing I'll say is that we think of the problem a bit like a medical problem. So we have a complicated sick patient, and we may need multiple types of treatment that operate on different time scales to get the patient healthy again. So we think of these climate interventions, what we've seen working with the scientific community, have in the most promising ones have centered around increasing the reflection of sunlight from particles and clouds in the atmosphere. And for a variety of reasons, scientists think from the perspective of something that could act quickly to cool the system off. There are examples that we've seen before in nature. There are ways in which we're doing it now with pollution. We have a little bit of a pollution shield. It's creating some cooling. So all of those things have led scientists to think that whether we like the idea or not, the most promising thing to look at might be whether we could, in a controlled way, increase the brightness of clouds or the outer atmosphere. And so what we think is, again, like a medical problem, is right now we don't know for sure. Your question, there are some theories about what might be most promising. And so the really important thing is that we push information and research quickly. Another area that scientists have looked at is this area of brightening clouds. And this came up because it's been observed that particles that come up from the surface and go into clouds under certain conditions make them brighter. You can see this from space, in particular over the ocean. You'll see these bright streaks in the clouds over the ocean, which are created by the pollution from ships. And so ships are doing this now. A lot of different sources of pollution, coal factories, transportation, are creating this kind of effect that brightens clouds. And in fact, today, it's thought to be providing a considerable cooling that offsets some of the greenhouse gas warming we would get. So there are folks that think that, you know, brightening clouds in a targeted way, in a cleaner way, over the ocean in particular, because the ocean is dark, the clouds are clean in certain regions, that you could create a concentrated effect that effectively sends the sun's energy back to space from patches of clouds. And by brightening just some patches of clouds, you could actually offset, you know, 1 or 2 degrees of warming. The other thing that they think when you do this is that you might affect the surface temperature of the ocean and the air in the lower atmosphere over the ocean. And that has effects on things like the Arctic and Antarctic regions, on storms and things like that. And so it might be a way to target cooling in a way that helps the system or helps certain impacts. But this is all very early and very uncertain, and it hits on a lot of the areas in which we've underinvested in what we observe and how we model the system. This cloud brightening effect happens to be highly uncertain to globally about a degree Celsius. One of the important considerations to your question is, so there are a couple of promising ways to cool the planet. The marine cloud brightening, the cloud brightening way, might have some targeted things you could do that are really interesting. But we have a problem in the sense that there's still a lot of uncertainty, so it's hard for us to answer the question now.
One thing I wanted to ask you was, there's been a lot of news recently about the pollution from things like shipping, from other sources as well. We've had a big cleanup and removal of certain aerosols, and there seems to be a warming effect of that which could be quite serious. How does what you're doing look into this problem? Because that's an aerosol problem as well. Is there something that marine cloud brightening could tell us about this or have an impact?
Well, that's
in some
a way? That's a great question, because it hits on kind of the two sides that we're concerned about. One is, like, we're very concerned about the near-term risk. So we know that the greenhouse gas warming will continue over the next few decades. The one thing that we have a pretty high confidence that we're successful at doing is cleaning up the pollution particles that are harmful to breathing, but that also tend to produce a cooling effect. So the one thing we're pretty sure we're going to do is actually take out some of that cooling. And we don't know exactly, you know, it's that big uncertainty that I mentioned before. We don't know what that means in terms of how much warming we're going to get. So they're starting to observe it, but this is really the first time. So this cooling effect has been in the climate, you know, the UN climate reports every time that there's this pretty substantial cooling effect that's highly uncertain coming from pollution, and it's not really talked about. And you see really just in the past month or so, this kind of, oh, wow, in addition to all the other problems we have this little cooling thing going on that we don't understand, and now it's coming out. You have really prominent people like Jim Hansen, you know, tying that to the fact that, well, you could actually do something similar on purpose. And so then you get to, okay, well, you know, what does this really mean? Well, scientifically, these things are similar. And marine cloud brightening, you know, brightening clouds of the ocean is very similar to what ships are doing in brightening clouds with their pollution, except that the ship stuff is very dirty and very non-optimized. So, so the question is, could you do something similar that's clean and optimized? In marine cloud brightening, they're proposing using sea salt particles, which are, you know, part of what's in the environment. And those sea salt particles that they want to use, they kind of isolate the dynamics. Like, ships are spewing out a mix of gunk that's hard to isolate what's really going on. See, these sea salt particles would allow you to actually kind of get a better grip on, you know, in a controlled way, what's really happening. So the research that the scientists want to do to study what the sea salt particles will do, they also think will help narrow the uncertainty on what the pollution is doing. So you get this big two-for-one with that research. And the National Academy of Sciences in the US even called it dual-purpose research. So of all the things, and granted, you know, I've been involved with marine cloud efforts from the beginning, so I'm not impartial. But of all the things in terms of return on investment, one of the things I like about the marine cloud brightening research is, you know, you win either way. You can probably find out with a modest amount of time and money whether marine cloud brightening has legs. And depending on the strength of the effect, that's going to tell you a lot about what bringing down the pollution is going to do. That's a matter of urgency. And I've said that to the science team at the White House and Congress. It's a matter of urgency that we understand better what's happening when we take the pollution away. Because, you know, we're at the edge of very dangerous dynamics, and we've got to understand that better. So in this case, the research path looks pretty similar to helping understand both those problems and pretty urgent.
Yeah, it's fascinating because in many respects, it's already a sort of an unintended intervention that has caused an issue, which by cleaning up, it shows that we are integral already at managing this climate. And if we don't respond when we need to, it could be catastrophic in things like food baskets.
Well, that's right. And it makes it a little bit of a difference in how you think about it, because people have thought about these things in terms of something like totally new and sort of Frankenstein. But if you think about, well, we have this one thing that's already going on in this category, we happen to be doing it accidentally in a really dirty way, and then it sort of shifts your thinking about, well, if we did something similar this way, it might sound a little less radical. It's still, all of these things are still, you know, really challenging in terms of, like, these forces as humans that we're putting on this system that's so wonderfully calibrated to keep us alive, you know. So it's a hard problem, and I'm very sympathetic to wanting to get it back to its, like, more natural, sustained state. But we may just have to travel through some arcs of, like, rebalancing and fixing what we've done.
Do you think with that in mind, if you were to look at global shipping, that it is in a way a sort of infrastructure because we're wholly dependent on shipping? And could it continue to be used as it's had a cooling effect? Is there a potential for that? Is that something you've considered?
The question, it definitely comes up. And right now, what we're very interested in is like, do our, you know, can our models and our scientific tools do that question? You know, right now we can't do that question very well. A couple of things I will say. One is that the scientists, experts that we know think like some of the targeted areas of clouds where you want to do this are in the more remote regions where the ships aren't traveling generally, like the Southern Ocean. So that's a factor. However, you do have the ships there and they are platforms. One of the stepwise things that we're doing, and we've been working with folks in the Department of Energy and NOAA and Amazon to think about putting observing instruments on the ships. So the first problem that we have, part of the reason we can't answer your question very well, is our observations of that marine environment, like what gases are being exchanged at the surface and what the aerosol cloud environment is like, they're pretty weak. And so if we can kit out the ships to get this really good information base, that's kind of a first step. So that's where we want to start. And then it's possible, looking at your question, you know, maybe there's a network way that you can optimize things using these platforms that are traveling around. People are looking at that question with airplanes too. So airplanes flying through the high cloud layer affect those clouds now. And by changing their routes, you might affect them in a way that's better. So definitely a great question. And definitely one that like we want to have enough of like the capabilities in place to do that question well.
One thing that really struck me from what you're saying is you said there's a lack of investment in this area in terms of trying to understand more. We've had this concurrent heat waves that is, when you look at the global map, it's just a global heat wave basically, but they are sort of separate in their entities. And recent research has shown but these are going to intensify. And this is having a dramatic impact on people on the social side. And have you looked at how the social attitude towards interventions has changed? Because I know it has been controversial, but is there more of a sort of openness to it now, do you think?
Our experience is maybe a little bit different than some on this topic, because in the United States, we've been dealing with U.S. Congress and policymakers and people from different states and people across the political spectrum. And we actually have found that the more opposition to climate intervention, or at least to research in these topics, tends to come from within the climate community. It's more concentrated there. And actually, in the general population, it's less controversial. And partly, I think that's because people are seeing, they're hearing in the news and they're seeing around them that the situation continues to worsen and that there isn't a plan that addresses the situation continuing to worsen. And so for, you know, what we've seen for policymakers and the general public, the idea that, well, people might be starting to research more aggressive or more extreme types of responses makes sense. Because, you know, the media is telling us the map doesn't add up and we're seeing the situations getting now a little bit frightening. So where we've seen the opposition and controversy has tended to be from within the climate community, where there's a lot of passion, rightfully so, for addressing the underlying problem and bringing the system back to a sustainable state. So you have a lot of passion that says, you know, we should have done these things. And 30, 40 years ago, we should have made, you know, small turns of the dial to bring greenhouse gases down. And so the fact that we're in the position that we're in now is pretty hard to swallow if you've been paying attention and working on this problem for a long time. However, looking at the system where it is and the dangers to people and the dangers to natural systems and ecology and biodiversity, we're now seeing there's more openness in those communities who were extremely opposed to this than there was in the past. And that's new.
And this sort of rapid increase in the last few years of impacts and the likelihood of that getting worse,
and you know, this sort of accelerating trend, and the fact that we're on the back foot with the where we are with things like research into this. How do you think we accelerate the research you're doing to, in the same way that the impacts are accelerated? You know, we always have to look at ways we can scale up our response to this problem that's kind of running away from us. Have you got a plan for that? Is that something that you're discussing with policymakers or other people, other parties?
It is actually, my research director came from DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Program Agency in the US, and I came from the IT infrastructure space, sort of deep areas of technology. So we think in terms of roadmaps, and we think in terms of what are the sequence of things that we need to invest in and get done if we want to, go from where we are today to a position that we can identify, a set of information and capabilities that we need, say, 4 or 5 years from now. So over the past couple of years, we've been working with senior scientists and other experts to try to identify what might be the components of a five-year roadmap that would put the world in a position, the United States and the world in a position to assess these interventions against these near-term climate risks that we're talking about. So that we, what are the investments? What's the information that we need to drive? And so we'll be publishing that in a couple of weeks, but we've been working with scientists and policymakers on it for a while. And over the past few years in the United States, some of what you're seeing where there's some motions forward in the US in this area, it's really about some of the scientific gaps that underlie being able to answer those questions, like what is really the effect of particles on clouds? What is really the trajectory of the permafrost problem or the trajectory of the ice sheet problem? And saying, okay, let's each year, each 6 months, each quarter, what do we need to get done to advance against those problems? So we've been working on that, and we're working that forward, particularly in the U.S., because the U.S. has a lot of capabilities to sort of fire up against this problem quickly. Also in the U.K., we funded the Met Office on some modeling work, which I'll talk about. So those countries and areas that have the assets, because you need pretty big assets to do climate science. You need supercomputers. You're working with giant data sets for the observations. You need gear out in the physical world, satellites, planes, UAVs, things like that. So we actually have kind of a systematic approach to how do we drive those things forward. Ultimately, in the United States, and we'll make this call to the rest of the world, we think there needs to be a step function, like a real, multi-billion dollar increase in investing against our observations and our model improvements. So separate from climate intervention, right, just to do the problem, we're not investing enough. And if you look at our investments in understanding and predicting the system relative to energy, carbon dioxide removal, raw advertising and street activism, climate research is the low man on the totem pole. So, and research investments have been relatively flat for the past few decades. So in the United States, I think maybe climate research overall is, in like the $4 or $5 billion. So if you compare that to energy investment or like the recent CHIPS bill or something, and you say, well, this is our best way at, getting a better handle on our risk problem, we need to step up our game. So we have that sort of macro level view of like, how do we push these investments forward? But then we have a very targeted view as well. And so in Silver Lining, we have those things like, what are the most important catalysts and what are the most important things you have to do now? And in Silver Lining, we've been, raising money from philanthropy to fund them directly. And in particular, some of these climate model pieces, like if I want to answer your question about what is the most promising way to cool, the climate quickly, then I need to start investing in having models being able to represent that. So we funded work at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in the US, and at the Met Office in the UK to do that, basically enable the models, add those things into the models, add in more representation of the chemistry and cloud specifics in the models to do that problem. And then similarly, we fund directly research at the level of like, what particles do we need to generate? And can we do that? And what does the process look like? How do you model that so that you can do these small things that tell you what how this would happen if you release it into the atmosphere and then play it out? So we're very concerned with just that systematic movement forward, that we get better information. And at this point, I would say again, from philanthropy, you know, I'm not worried that billionaires are going to go out and do this. Let's put it that way. you know, it's still been pretty, you know, pretty modest progress, pretty modest funding to date.
You mentioned that a lot of the focus is on the modeling and it's on the computer power, if you like. I know that I've spoken to the Met Office a couple of times and they've built a new big supercomputer. One of the things we talked about was the services they provide as a sort of offering a level of protection to society as we move into this more unstable climate. Do you think there's a point where the services will be integrated with these interventions in terms of deployment, or do you think we're moving in that direction, or we should be considering moving in that direction? Is there a role that, say, the Met Office, I mean, if they're looking at how these things might respond, how do you see this playing out within, say, the next 10 years of the role that someone like the Met Office could play in helping understand the interventions, but also perhaps monitor them once they're deployed?
Well, that's a great question, because it sort of represents our theory of how we think about these things, because we think the primary problem in understanding interventions is an information problem. And so the goal you're trying to get to is that people like the Met Office and NOAA, who owns the Weather Service in the US, that they will be able to monitor and, you know, project what these things would do. And so if society was going to make a decision about doing these things, you know, members of society, that institutions like the Met Office and NOAA would be able to advise society on how that would go, and even be an information layer that's relevant to observing and understanding what these things would do. So we think it's pretty essential. And in fact, the whole goal of research, it would be, you can think about trying to populate like what the Met Office or NOAA, how much they would be able to say to their nation, to the world about how these things would work. So pretty critical, I think, from our point of view. We don't see a universe where anyone's implementing interventions without these bodies being involved and advising policymakers. And the same at the international level, where it's a little less operational, but the WMO, the Montreal Protocol in the outer atmosphere, really critical that these atmosphere, climate, and weather bodies for their countries and the world are the ones everyone's going to look to. And so for us, all of these things, you know, kind of pass through them in a way.
I mean, you're talking about regions, the US, the UK, these different entities have very high resolution over their own areas. Is there that kind of capability all over the world at the moment, or is that being built?
No, there really isn't. And I love that you're asking this question, because in Silver Lining, this was an ecosystem we didn't know fully. And one of the things that we think about the evolution of climate interventions is the idea that if you have good research and you're able to make tools and capabilities and data available to people around the world to look at the question of how will this affect us and what do we think about it. So our theory is, you know, that the goal is to enable people around the world and their experts to answer those questions for themselves. There's a real problem in the disparity of not only technology, which is a big deal, but also just money. So we've come to find out that, you know, climate scientists in different parts of the world, they don't have anywhere to go for funding. So you have two significant problems. One is that just to work on like model questions and questions about if I'm in Africa, how would impacts affect me and would climate interventions help against drought, against, you know, different things. To do that problem, I need access to pretty significant computing and data that I don't have. And I also need money because as a scientist, I don't have a place to go for it. So part of our work in Silver Lining has ended up being, we're working with some delegations in the UN arena to look at this capacity problem, which I hadn't expected to be as bad as it is. Because I would have thought with like lots of attention on climate justice and lots of people and money around the table in various ways, that there would be pots of money for climate researchers studying impacts in the global south, and there just aren't. So it is right now for us, it's an area that, you know, we're kind of putting up a flag to say, hey, philanthropy nations, we need money and then technical access for researchers in the global south if we want to say that their participation is meaningful in decisions. And it happens to be in climate intervention, it's very stark. Like, hey, we want to cool the planet and we would really like everyone to be able to look at it. In reality, this should be true for the other impact forecasts and climate response and pathway decisions that are getting made. But I'll speak bluntly, I think their participation is largely more superficial than it should be because they don't have the capacity to actually do the science. They have the smart people and the lucky ones, you know, end up studying somewhere else. But there's lots of talent. So it's not a talent problem. It's a money and technology access and focus problem. And I think it's a moral problem that because this, in relative dollar terms, this is fixable. It's fixible very quickly.
I mean, you're talking about...
I got in a rant on that one. You call me on it. Also, because we found the people that we work with, we've funded some Global South people. There's a lot of talent that we're not taking advantage of to work on these problems.
And do you think there's also emergent knowledge because of the fact that they are experiencing things ahead of us?
There's certainly, yes, and a perspective difference. I mean, it's one of the things that makes diversity valuable. And we've found there's a diversity of views in, you know, in vulnerable regions and developing countries like there is everywhere else. But we've certainly found a lot of people who are very interested in research and interventions in a very pragmatic way because they've got immediate disaster risk problem. And so those perspectives are really important. And the questions they want to ask are really important in terms of like what the models need to do, what we need to look at. So having them around the table, I think you're correct. It brings an important element that isn't adequately represented.
And it'll be interesting at the next COP, because it's in Africa, it's an African COP or a vulnerable nation COP in many respects, of how this point can be made, that it's not a case of the global south begging the global north to help them or whatever. It should be actually very much a knowledge exchange, a solidarity, because we're all in, you know, there's so much to gain but also so much to give. And it's kind of, we're not really taking advantage of any of these potential synergies that, I mean, the global north is so far from being prepared for anything. It's terrible in itself, but the global south are actually experiencing it much harder than we are.
Yeah. So as you probably gathered, we're kind of pro the benefits of science, not just science for the things that you know, but the way people work together. And so there are lots of benefits if you beef up the support for the scientists in these regions and they're collaborating and cooperating and, you know, we're having a better dialogue. And so people are around the table, like a big part of what the UN communities do is they bring people around the table. But if they don't have the resources to actually work on a problem, then they're still in the dark sitting at the table, you know? And so there's a real positive opportunity. And the return on investment is high. I mean, this is a much easier problem than, you know, than distributing payments for damages and so on. This is relatively small potatoes to beef up, you know, scientific resources. But I think the value you get in terms of actual collaboration and actual input is probably somewhat game changing.
do you see a sort of a timeline and even a way that this could exponentiate the response? Is it purely a funding issue? What are the things that can really accelerate our response now? Because people who previously haven't even noticed this problem are now getting genuinely worried. Many, many more people are impacted and vulnerable. Is there a way you see forward to exponentiate our response to this?
Well, you know, sounding not impartial, but direct funding for research right now, because the research base is low, even relatively modest funding gets a huge amount of lift. You know, we're talking about just the really some of the only efforts in the world to look at how you advise the clean particles you want to generate, some of the early modeling efforts, even the, like, we funded $4 million to date in recipient funds, and that's just, it's produced this blossoming of now, you know, dozens and dozens of research studies and proved models. First information about how the particles work. So getting relatively modest amounts of money into that kind of catalyst research quickly is important. And then at the governmental level, I think the big concern that we have is whether this problem gets approached in a science-based way. Like if you think about the COVID pandemic and the development of vaccines, you know, you had a period in the US where there was RNA research going on for quite some time. And then you had this kind of concentrated development rush towards vaccines and information. And that was really critical to us then having vaccines and having a way to dampen things down. There's a tendency in this space to kind of want to bring in opponents and bring in sort of non-science-based decision-making into the question of whether research can go forward at all. So we're encouraging people to, you know, remind their policymakers, remind their environmental groups, remind each other that science and information, what we do with that can be good or bad, but having that is the tool that we have here. And so what we don't want to do is politicize the generation of information or stigmatize it or not have it happen. And that's a real risk right now at the UN level, at the national level, because efforts to block and stigmatize this type of research have worked really well and very easily. So I think, you know, both things, that people having more conversations about this and the spheres that they're in, whether it's, you know, the business communities that they're in, whether it's environmental communities, whether it's schools, to really look at it, especially look at the science and those people who just really genuinely care about, you know, what the real answers are.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
Gosh, it feels like we're always sort of behind the curve on this. And by the time people come around to doing the right thing, we wish we were doing it 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
I think that's very true. Our motto, and we didn't invent it, but we like it, is failure is not an option.
Yeah, sure. Okay, well, look, thank you very much for speaking to me. It's been fantastic, very insightful.
Well, thank you, Nick. Take care and good luck with your show.
Thanks again for listening. If you are interested to help support this series and help expand the discussion around climate topics, then please do consider backing my channel via Patreon. It will help me produce more content and you will also gain access to more expert interviews. It would be great to engage more with audiences too and understand your views on these topics.